Hello and welcome to episode 29 of the Derailed Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Fred.
Fred, are you experiencing 18XX withdrawal?
I am. I'm so keen to play, man.
I was going to say, again. It's been a while since we played.
Hey? It has, yeah. It has.
So I played one game without you on Saturday. One of my friends from school was down. He lives overseas now.
Mm.
And he was down. So we had kind of like a game day with some of my school friends.
Okay.
Yeah, so there were five of us. We played a game of 89, but I was thinking about how long it's actually been since we played a game like with our whole group.
Yes.
Yeah, I feel like it's been a while.
It was 62 last, but...
Was it? How long ago is it? Has it only been like 2 weeks?
I think it's only been like 2 weeks, but yeah, that is too long.
Feels like a lifetime.
Yes.
I think it feels like that because we haven't discussed a game. It feels like we haven't discussed a game on the podcast in quite a while.
Yeah, last week we had like... the listener topics and things, yeah. So we haven't discussed a play, really.
Yes, yeah. And today we had a couple of topics we wanted to talk about as well. Mm. Yeah, so someone in our Discord mentioned, speaking about sort of a 18XX collection, like what games you would recommend or what games you'd look into. Mm. Yeah, in terms of maybe complexity level, also what different styles of games. So kind of like if you had, I don't know... budget for like 5 18XX games or six or less than 10, I suppose. You get to a certain point where you can just have everything, I guess.
Yeah.
But sort of like what would you prioritize or what would be like a good collection that gives you some variety across those things. So we thought we'd chat about that a little bit. And then I wanted to talk about stock trashing.
Okay.
As well. Yeah. So it's sort of a, I don't want to say a common strategy, but it's certainly something that I think a lot of people have considered.
Mm.
In the context of a game like 1830, if you sell everyone's shares just to depreciate their stock value, is it worthwhile doing? When should you be doing it? That kind of stuff. So I wanted to have a discussion around that as well.
Okay, cool.
But first, I wanted to talk to you about something that happened in our game of 89.
Okay.
Which I thought was really interesting. So to set a bit of background, I suppose, all the people that we were playing with, I was the only kind of experienced 18XX, if I can even call myself experienced, which I guess I wouldn't, but way more experienced than them. Four of them had played one game of 89 before with me, and that's it. And one of them had attempted to fumble their way through Cologne a few times.
Okay.
On my recommendation, but I think they had been getting a lot of rules wrong. So I think they appreciated playing 89 because they're like, oh, this is how tokening works.
Right.
Oh, this is how you lay track. Okay, I've screwed a lot of things up.
Yeah, it helps to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, done.
But they're all gamers. They're all proper gamers, strategy gamers, things like that. So competitive, strategic, that kind of thing. So no problem with heavy games and stuff like that. So what happened in the very first stock round, which I thought was interesting, because we'd spoken about collusion before.
Yes.
I think we had an episode where we chatted about collusion before.
Yeah.
And there was a case of like very blatant collusion going on.
Okay.
And I thought it was interesting for a few reasons. I think the baseline reason is this okay? Like just to straight up collude. But beyond that, there was sort of a strategic nuance to it, which I thought was interesting. So I'm going to explain the situation. One of my friends and the other friend decided that they wanted to work together because after the private auction, one of them had enough money to float at the minimum, but the other one didn't. So the other one proposed that they work together, that they basically like run a company together.
Okay.
So in that they parred at a higher price. So instead of like the baseline, which is 65, they parred at, let's say, like 80. So my other friend wouldn't be able to do that on his own.
Yeah.
And this friend wouldn't be able to par even at 65. So he was like, okay, so I'll buy the presidency for 80 and then you buy shares and I'll buy shares. And then eventually the other friend would have ended up with the presidency because this guy could only afford to buy maybe 3 shares at that price, right? So in a baseline level, how do you feel about this so far? Like just straight up being like, let's make a deal. We'll run this company together. We'll both get something out of it because we'll both have a floated company that's operating from the beginning.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I don't see a problem with it. It's similar to what we discussed before where we were saying, oh, if you buy this share and I buy this share, then we can force X person to float Y company. I think it's the same kind of thing.
So yeah, there's a lot of people who get hung up on the idea of collusion. And there's also like people who feel like it's okay to have indirect collusion. So let's say you have the presidency of the B&O and I want to force you in 1830 and I want to force you to float it because I don't want you getting revenue. So I buy one share of it. But I can only afford to buy one, maybe two shares.
Yes.
I can say it out loud, like, hey, everyone buy a share, let's agree to this, blah, blah. Or I can just do it and hope that everyone else recognizes
it. Yeah, realizes what you're doing, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of a weird line that I don't know if I care too much about. I didn't care that much about the collusion, although it was so blatant that I was a little bit like, yo, this is...
No, but I think it's exactly the same thing as we've done before. Like, you and I worked together to force Simon to float a company before. That was what we discussed in our collusion episode.
Yeah, and
we discussed it out loud as well. You said, if I buy one of these and you buy one, then we can float this company.
It was just weird to me because I'd never seen this before. That was so like blatantly like, we're going to be allies from the beginning. Okay, let's pool our money together. What can we float at? Like, that's literally how this conversation was going, right? Okay, but this is where it gets interesting.
Okay.
The guy who was going to buy the presidency first, he had enough for 3 shares, let's say.
Okay.
Maybe 2, but I think he had enough for 3.
Okay.
So what I pointed out to them, and I, so maybe you can see the problem as well. Let's say this guy buys the presidency, right? Now it comes around to his ally. What's his ally's best move? From like a game theory kind of perspective. Not even game theory, just strategically.
This is the first stock round.
Yeah.
But he can't float anything on his own, the second person.
The second person can, at the lowest price. He can float on his own.
Oh, okay. Well, he can probably do that then. Float something else at the lowest price.
And essentially remove that other person from the game.
Yes. Yeah. Like, have him stuck with 2 shares not doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah. At most, that guy can buy 3. The amount of time it would take for his revenue to get to the point where he could buy 2 more shares at 80 is, I don't know, let's say he was earning $20 an OR.
So what he would have to do is, okay, he's bought the presidency, but then when his friend doesn't stick to the deal, he would have to buy some other share and hope to make some more money in the meantime.
Yeah, it would be, he'd be out of the game, I would say.
I don't think he's out of the game completely. Those 2 shares still count towards your net worth. They're not earning you anything. But if the game ended, he would have those 2 shares value.
I feel like your money, your initial capital not doing anything for you for that long, I think that if people are playing at like a reasonable level, we assume everyone's playing at the same level, I think it's game ending. It's basically taking $160 out of your starting capital, just like straight.
Yeah, I don't think it's that bad. Like it's bad, but he's not out of the game. I don't think he's out of the game.
He'd be done, dude. I mean,
I don't think he's done. I don't think he's done.
I feel like if we were talking like high level play, he's done. It's way too much of a screw up, I think, to still be reasonably in the game. I think it would require other people to make enormous mistakes because it's just too much. 160 out of your starting capital is that you can't do anything with for like 8 stock rounds or some crap. Like, it's just not stock rounds, sorry, operating rounds. It's just,
it's not great, but I don't think you call the game. Like,
I think you call the game for him. I'm not saying the game's over. I'm saying that he would be in an unwinnable position. I think so. But if not unwinnable, at least we can agree terrible position.
I wouldn't even say terrible. I think it's not great, but I if I were him, I'd keep playing.
Oh my word. $160 that you can't do anything with.
I would now start trashing other guy who didn't stick to the deal's stock. Start buying up his shares.
Like, one at a time, one per stock round.
Yeah, but the thing is, he sells it and then buys a different share.
Yeah. And you think that guy's going to be in the game? I think we should simulate this and you should see how incredibly screwed you are.
Okay.
I think by like the 3rd stock round, you'd be like, yeah, okay, I'm done.
Okay.
I'm out of this game. Yeah, it's not happening. Because I'd be like running routes. I would have bought in my privates. I would have like sold down my shares. I'd be floating my like 2nd or 3rd company by the time you can float this 1st one.
Yeah.
You'd be.
But I'm not necessarily trying to float that 1st one anymore.
It doesn't matter. You've got no capital to do anything.
Yeah. Well, you do. You can buy shares.
Okay. You'd have 3 shares and I'd have 8.
I don't think it's that big of a difference. I agree it's bad. I don't agree that he's out of the game.
It's like pretty close to 3 shares that he's lost at the beginning of the game.
No, he's lost 2 shares.
No, no. He spent 80 on that, remember? So he spent 160. So 3 shares at 65 is 195.
Yeah, okay.
That's a pretty huge deficit for the start of the game.
Yes. It's not great.
Oh, my word. You are such an optimist, dude. This guy's out of the game. Anyway, so it doesn't matter. what I was basically saying to the second guy is that if he, let's say he sets it at 80 and he says, cool, I'm buying the presidency. The second guy, the best strategic move for him by far is to float a totally different company on his own.
Yeah.
No question. Right. So maybe that's the only point we really need to make on that, because it would damage that other guy so much.
Yeah.
And he's gaining so little by like helping with this little endeavor.
Mm.
So I pointed that out to them because we were like kind of discussing the like collusion aspect of it. And I was like, well, the biggest problem I have with it is that you're making a terrible move by buying this presidency at 18.
Yeah, there's like, even though you make the deal, there's no,
it's not,
there's no rule in 18xx that it's binding.
So if the other guy was playing optimally,
yes,
he would not go along with this. He would say he would maybe, but he's not going to.
Yeah.
Which then makes his move, in my opinion, objectively bad.
Mm.
Like buying presidency for a company you can't float, if you take all the like collusion nonsense out of it, it's just objectively bad.
Yeah.
Like you're just tying up 164 eons that, in my opinion, will eliminate you effectively from the game, right?
Okay.
So yeah, I thought it was kind of an interesting situation because, yeah, where do you go from there? Like, it's this weird thing where like the collusion aspect of it changes as it goes. So they make this deal, he buys it, now it goes to the other person. And from a game theory kind of perspective, the best thing strategically for him to do is to not follow through on this deal.
Yeah, but I think that's pretty much the exact same situation we had with that game against Simon. Because it was my turn. I could afford one more share. And you told me, Fred, if you buy a share in Simon's company, I'll buy the next one, which forces it to float. If you back out of that deal, now I'm stuck with a share not doing anything. It's the exact same situation.
It's a little bit less damaging, but it is very similar.
Yeah, it's one share instead of two shares.
Yeah, and I guess I'd say then that that is also probably bad then. Like,
well, that's why I didn't want to do it.
yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I hear you. But they ended up not doing it because I pointed out that for him to do it was objectively bad.
Mm.
And I think that for me is almost like a line in a way. It's sort of like if the move you're making is like game ending, if the other person doesn't follow your deal, then it feels like you are now playing almost like outside the, I don't know, the kind of like constraints of the game in a way.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's kind of like self-correcting. Like, so collusion could be profitable for both of them, but if they don't fully trust each other, then it's in neither of their best interest to make the deal.
So the way I basically framed it for this guy was like, if you were playing in like a tournament or something, this move would be awful.
Mm.
If you were in the World Cup of 1830 or 1889, what you're doing right now would effectively be like the worst thing possible.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And I think if you are trying to be competitive or strategic, I think taking that into mind, it sort of then shines a light on the collusion thing being like a bit, I don't know, weird. So what I said to him was, if you really want to go through with this, what you should do is pass.
Mm.
And if he buys
the other person power it, yeah.
But then it doesn't make sense for the other person to power at a price that they can't afford either.
Mm.
So then that other person ended up powering at a price that they could afford.
Mm.
Yeah, and then I told him he's much better off buying the shares in stock round two because he shouldn't help the other person float it. So we kind of got in the weeds on this whole deal in the first place, right? So that's what ended up happening. Person number two floated at like 70 or something.
Mm.
And then I said, you should wait till he has 5 shares before you buy it, because why help him float?
I've changed my mind about that, but we'll get to that in the stock crashing.
Oh.
Because, okay, so person B now in this case can par at 70. If person A starts buying those shares, person B has to spend less in order to float it, yes.
Yeah.
But then in the next stock round, player A can now sell those shares, and that affects player B.
But what if you just wait for him to get to 50% before you buy 2 of his shares?
Yeah, you can do that as well. But then you're most likely acting last, and then player B can sell before you do.
I think it's worth it to not give them free money.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you make them pay 30% for 100% of the treasury, I think that's bad.
We must play, Chris. We must play a game, man.
Yeah.
So many things I want to try.
Exactly. Yeah, because that's what I said to him as well. I said, you can buy in stock round one if you want to.
Yeah.
Even though it probably, arguably, makes more sense just to buy in stock round two. But you should buy after he's reached 50%. Because otherwise, he can just stop at 30.
Yeah, then you can only buy one, though. Because otherwise, you risk getting it dumped on you.
Well, if he's going to buy 2 anyway, I mean, then buy it after he's floated it, not before.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, having a company dumped on you at that stage isn't so bad either.
Because No.
It wouldn't have been able to buy your private companies from you yet and stuff like that. So
yeah.
It's fine.
It's pretty tricky to get then in R01.
Yeah.
Is it even possible? I guess maybe.
I think it is. But if not everyone is floating a company, it's maybe not possible.
Yeah. And it's only possible to actually buy your privates if you're the last person or whatever to buy the trains.
Yeah.
So you're probably fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So I thought it was kind of an interesting scenario.
Yeah, I don't think it's that much different to the case we had before. We were just where we decided collusion was okay. So I don't have a problem with it. But yeah, strategically, it's if everyone is playing selfishly, then it's in no one's...
I think I only had a problem with it because strategically, it didn't make sense.
Mm.
And I think that was my only issue with it. I was kind of like... I can make a case for this being objectively bad.
Well, even if they went through with it, at some point, whoever has the president's cert is going to screw over the other person.
Yeah, well, that's what I said as well. I was like, you guys are trying to make alliances. It's not how this game works. Like,
at some point, someone's going to screw someone
over. If you don't have the presidency, you need to. Your alliance will end swiftly.
Oh, yeah. You're in danger if you don't have the presidency in that scenario at some point. Yeah. Yeah.
So it is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think I would have let them do it just to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I said to them, basically, you can do it. This is what you're risking.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was an interesting kind of discussion, you know. Yeah. And then he decided not to go through with it. Not because he didn't trust the other person, but just I think because he's a strategically minded person, it just didn't feel right to him to do something that was kind of like you could make an objective case for being bad strategy.
Yeah.
He was just like, I don't want to do it then.
You're taking a big risk, yeah.
Yeah, and a pointless risk.
Yeah.
Because, there's no need to
do
that. The other guy wouldn't have screwed him because it would have been unfun. Like he would have just been... Mm. Out of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Someone graph this thing. Someone graph this exact situation and tell me if this dude has a chance of coming back. I feel like we should get some opinions. I think people must weigh in on this.
Well, I think we should just get out 89 and simulate it.
Yeah, that's true as well. I'm trying to get Team Chris versus Team Fred going. You know what I mean? I want to see who's on whose side. Yeah, we should run a poll or something.
Team Fred all the way, man. Come on.
Team Optimist.
Yeah. Shall we talk about patrons quickly?
Oh, yes.
We have some new ones.
Perfect.
So we have Thomas Louis.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we read his email last week.
Yes, and he said in Discord that you pronounced his surname correctly when you said Louis. So
yeah, and that was the one that I thought was wrong. I was it could be Louis. I'm like, Louis, no, definitely not. And he's like, no, that was right.
And we have this one. I'm not sure about the pronunciation. Peter Chaublom or Chaublommer. Blommer at the end of your surname there is exactly how you would spell Blommer, which is flowers in Afrikaans. So.
Yeah, we're giving that the Afrikaans pronunciation for sure. So if it's like Scandinavian or something, apologies.
And then we have Ruan Null, which is one of your friends that played on Saturday.
Ruan was the guy who fumbled his way through 1893 Cologne.
No, thanks very much, guys. We appreciate the support.
He was very sucked in.
Mm. That's awesome.
By 89, he was like, he played it like once and he was like, this could be like the best game I've ever played.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you get it.
That's brilliant.
You know what's up.
Yeah, well, you played on Saturday. He signed up on Sunday as a patron. So
hey, nice.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, thanks to all three of you.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. We really, really appreciate it.
Mm. Then there was one other thing I just wanted to mention before we carry on. So last week we spoke about the Dads on a Map game and you asked me if I was going to go bankrupt. And I said, no, I don't think so. I was wrong.
Yeah. Because I looked at you. I was like, this guy's screwed. I pinned all the blame for our loss on you. I was like, Fred, if only. But this actually led to an interesting scenario, right? Where you could have juggled the train.
Mm.
Yeah. This is that weird, like we were talking about this thing of. Did we talk about it on the podcast? I think we did. Yeah, we did. If it makes sense to juggle trains and just stay in the game just for the sake of it. And I think we both sort of agreed that it doesn't if you aren't going to. You were a little bit more willing to if you felt like you could sort of improve your position or fight for third place or whatever. I was like, if I'm out the game and I can go bankrupt, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So this was kind of interesting because if you had juggled those trains. You could have engineered a weird scenario in which James would have had to buy a train, which would have put my net worth higher.
Yeah.
Which would have made me win the game if you had just gone bankrupt the next time it happened.
But I think that would have been king-making, especially in this particular game.
100%, yeah. So it would have been so, like, unsporting, I feel like. But I guess it's one of those scenarios in which you could do it, but it doesn't feel like it's in the spirit of doing it.
Yeah. So in this particular game, in case people don't remember, this was a game, Chris and I against James and Sanchez from Dads on a Map. And we basically said, whoever wins this game, like, their podcast wins the game. Yes. But there's no collusion. We can't be playing together. So, so I didn't want to king make in that situation.
No, it would have been such a feel bad win. Because that's the thing. It makes sense. Like, if you're out, you're out. And this was a scenario where just juggling trains back and forth made no sense.
Yeah.
You knew you were done. So it's just like, cool, I'm bankrupt.
Yeah.
Game over.
Yeah.
And just the operating order basically decided the game because you went before James, then he didn't have to buy the train. So he hadn't have to pay his 1100 or whatever that he would have to pay. Which is cool. I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
I think he said he had a plan to try and shuffle some things himself or whatever. So
I think he could have shuffled as well. He also had two companies operating, I think.
So we could have ended an endless shuffle of... but that's the thing, right? If you can't do it, just bankrupt.
Yeah, just end it. Yeah, so good game. Well played.
James well played. Dads on a Map. Damn it.
Yeah.
There was some weird stuff that game, actually. Like, I remember James in, like, stock round one floated... Or pod Pennsylvania at like 100. I was like, what is this guy doing? But eating my words now, James. So, well done. Yeah, we just had one email.
That right there is the mail. Now let's talk about the mail. Can we talk about the mail, please, Mac? I'm dying to talk about the mail with you all day, okay?
So this one is from Alex Prudenta. Could have that wrong. You can just always, it's Alejandro. So I wonder how you'd say that. Prudente? Prudenta? I don't know. Anyway. So he said, hello, love your podcast. Glad you're enjoying your discovery. Definitely. So he pointed out a couple of things that we might have gotten wrong with 1862. So the one that he pointed out, I think we definitely got wrong, or at least I did anyway. He said that all trains must always touch a station. So the reason that I've got this wrong was that the way I read the rules was that you have like a home train that sort of runs one route and then all the other trains just have to link to that route in some way, even without touching a station. I feel like this may be a little bit of an ambiguity in the rule book because I feel like it sort of implies that, but anyway, it's something that's defined later on in the rule book as has to touch a station.
I think I understood it correctly. So I think I understood that your main route has to touch the home station and then other routes have to intersect the main route at some point. But I also think that all my routes were touching another station as well.
Yeah, so this is weird, right? In particular with 62, because one of your routes actually has to touch your home station, but then you have all these other stations and your other like non-home routes just have to touch one of those.
Yeah, they just have to intersect somewhere with the main route.
Yeah, so that's why it's kind of weird. They have to intersect with the main route and they have to touch one station, but not necessarily your home station.
Yeah. I think I did it the way it should be done, but I'm not sure. We'll look out for that next time we play.
I had so many stations that I probably touch one of them. The main constraint really is having to touch your home station.
Yes.
That's what makes it tricky because companies always basically have to operate outwards from one particular area.
Yeah.
So the home station location actually becomes really, really important.
Yeah.
And that matters a lot for mergers as well. Because if you're going to merge two companies, you actually also have to look at which one is the more desirable home station.
Yes.
Because you replace all the tokens with your own.
Right, yeah.
But home station is actually critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that.
Mm.
Okay. So he pointed out another thing. I don't think we confused this. This was just maybe something that I said wrongly in the podcast. You pointed out to me and the Board Game Informant guys did as well. I can't remember. I was talking about freight trains and then counting hexes or something like that. But do you remember what it was? Because I said I messed something up because it applied to me, but it wasn't the general rule.
I think the thing you said wrong on the podcast that I pointed out afterwards, I didn't pick it up during the podcast, but I pointed it out afterwards, was that freight trains had to start or end on the main route, whereas they could just intersect. Like, I think you said something about you weren't able to count that location twice because of it or something.
Yeah, I think that maybe what I implied was that any revenue location on the freight train's route counted as counted. counted as counted, but then it counted for the rule that you can't count the same revenue area twice or something like that. Yeah. But if you go back and listen to that, whatever I said about my freight train and the other train intersecting and not being able to score revenue center twice or something, it was just the case for me. It wasn't a general rule. There was something about that that I messed up.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, what Alex was saying was that you don't count revenue locations more than once, but the hexes in between the first and last hex of a train run aren't considered revenue locations. So I think that is what he's saying, that if your freight train runs across five hexes, you don't count the middle three as revenue locations if it didn't collect revenue from them, which it didn't.
Yeah, some other train can still run those.
You can still score those. Yeah. I think what happened for me was that where my train intersected with my freight train was on the most profitable revenue location, and it kind of screwed me up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sorry about that. A couple of people have told me about that. I blame the tiredness. So he said, third error, maybe those bonus hexes do not even need to have been traversed by the freight train to be counted as the crow flies. I'm not sure what we said on the podcast, but this is something I think that we definitely knew, that even if your freight train sort of does like a C shape, imagine like quite a big C, you count the hexes in between the two points as the crow flies. It doesn't need to follow the route of the train. Yeah. Perfect. But thank you, Alex. Thanks for pointing that out. And I meant to, I think last week actually mentioned that mistake I made of 62, but I forgot then as well.
Okay, so
there we go. Overdue correction. Sweet. But thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. And then, do you want to talk about games a little bit?
Okay.
Yeah. So we were going to talk about, so this came up in our Discord, right? This idea of like a kind of like a game collection or something. So I don't think we have to spend too much time on this, but I thought it was an interesting question. I think for me, availability is a big factor in this as well.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of games that people like people, for example, often recommend 1860 as a two-player game, but 1860 costs $200.
Right.
On like the aftermarket, and it's like impossible to get, and
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. So it sort of then rings hollow for me as a recommendation. Like, not many people are going to be wanting to spend that much on something like that. So someone asked about sort of the idea of sort of what kind of collection you would start with, or maybe like curating a sort of 18XX collection, like what you'd recommend as like beginner games or ones that tackle different areas, like operational games versus stock games, or like next step games. So like you've done the beginner stuff, but what's like a good like step up from that? And then like niche games or like some side stuff that does something different or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'll run through a few of mine and you can see if you agree with me.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So for me, I now firmly have 1889 as my like number one beginner game.
Yeah, I agree with that.
If you can only buy one 18XX, I feel like I'd tell you to buy that one.
Mm.
I just think it does everything so well. It's still really fun for me to play. I still really enjoy it.
Mm.
It's become this game now that feels like just like easy and clean, and like it's almost like relaxing, even though it's just like, it's just fun. It's just got a nice trajectory. I know what I'm doing. It just feels great to play that game. It's just a nice full cap stocky kind of game, but it's got some good variety because it's like kind of like a stock game in the sense that there's a full 1830 style stock market, things like that. But there's also, it also can be sort of like a run good company kind of game as well.
Yeah.
Which I've noticed. So the guy who won our game of 89 was not me. that we played on Saturday. But he actually played quite a run good company game. He parred this company quite high early on. And he had enough in his treasury. He bought like a few two trains or whatever, but he didn't have any good privates. So he didn't really drain his treasury. So then he managed to buy a three train, and then he bought a four train as well.
Okay.
With the same treasury. So he never reached that point where he sort of like sold it down. He just ran good revenue off of it and then like floated another company, I think at some point. Managed to get a permanent in there, all that kind of stuff. And his stock appreciation just never stopped.
Right. Okay.
So he basically won because he had 60% of this company and the stock ended up on like 270 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so he won off the back of that, whereas the rest of us, our stock never got that high.
Mm.
So that was actually kind of interesting because it was just purely like a run good company sort of strategy. But it worked. And I've heard that said about 89 before, that it can be a few different games depending on how it kind of goes. So It's got good variety. I really like it. I think I feel really safe recommending it now that Grand Trunk Games is doing their Kickstarter next year.
Yes.
Where it's getting like the full production retail kind of vibe.
Yeah.
It's getting that whole thing. So it's going to be really accessible.
It will be, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm really happy about that because for me, that's still the best.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's a very good game, especially for a first-time player.
And so that's kind of like a stock game more than an operational game. I mean, I don't think the route running and stuff there's that much interesting stuff going on there. I think it can be like a run good company game. I think it can be a money manipulation game. You can even do the yellow brown strat stuff if you want to.
Right.
Like there's a lot of cool, interesting stuff you can do, but it's not very operational. I don't think it'll ever be incredibly operationally focused. The routes are relatively simple.
Yeah, it's not a very intimidating map. It's not.
Yeah. So for an operational beginner game, I really feel like 46 comes to mind, but I'm just so loath to recommend it because I really don't like it.
Yeah, no, I don't think really there's any reason to have 46.
You just offended so many people.
It is accessible, maybe still fairly, so...
It's very operational, right? There's so much routes and calculation and stuff happening on the map. I actually found it tiresome by the end of it.
Yeah. A lot of people have said that. Like, a lot of people... We said that the last time we spoke about 46, is that towards the end, it feels like the routes are difficult to calculate, right? Like you have to recalculate them all the time and they're long and it's difficult.
So I suppose maybe if you like that, that's okay. But for me, that just kind of felt like hard work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm sort of loath to recommend it. But the only other game I could think of that's sort of like a quite an easy, potentially operational game is one I haven't played, which is at 1867/61. That Kickstarter, Grand Trunk Games' first Kickstarter that they did recently. That apparently is quite an operational game.
Okay.
It's just a little bit more complicated in the sense that I think it has like a bit of a merger situation and stuff like that. Mm. But I think that it's relatively simple.
Okay.
It's quite short. It's relatively simple. So I kind of want to lean more towards that and just say, yeah, maybe it's closer to like a next step, but I'm just like, just go for that.
Yeah.
Just go for that. If you really want like a Euro style track laying game with some stock market stuff in it, then 46 is fine, okay. I guess.
Yeah.
Yo, we are so rude about 46 on this podcast. But yeah, that's kind of how I feel. So me personally, I'd say more like 61, 67, because that is a bit more operational.
Right.
So what do you think in terms of like a next step up, kind of like a stock game?
Maybe Cologne. I don't know how easy it is to get though. But what's also nice about Cologne is it starts introducing mergers.
Yeah, I like Cologne as well. I don't know where it fits in. It's such a small step up. That's kind of an interesting hybrid one because it can be quite operational, but we've had some nice stock stuff going on there. It's not as stock heavy as something like 89, I don't think, but we've definitely had interesting back and forth. And I think the nice thing about the merge is that it's actually a bit of a stock battle as well.
Yes.
A lot of that happens in the stock round, that sort of battle. So I think that makes it kind of interesting as well.
Yeah.
So I like that one as well. I think the obvious choice maybe is 1830 for like a stock game. Yeah, that's like a pure stock game in my opinion. I don't actually like that as a beginner game. I've seen people recommend it as a beginner game. And I can see why, because the rules aren't that bad. But it's a slog, I think, if you're brand new. It's very long if you're new, because you're not going to push the trains quickly enough. The bank is huge. So I just feel like you could put people off if that was their first game. They'd be playing it for like 8 hours. And they're going to be like, yo, this was a bit hectic. Like, I don't know if we do this again. Whereas 89, you can finish, even as new players, it would be more like the 4 hour mark, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that. So I worry about it. I also worry about how restrictive the tiles are. So all 18XXs are mean, right?
Mm.
But for me, 1830 has some meanness baked into it that is kind of a feel bad if you're a new player.
Right.
So for me, having a company dumped on you isn't actually that much of a feel bad.
Mm.
It's more like a, oh, crap, you got me kind of moment, you know? Like, oh, crap, I'm on the hook. Oh, and if it's really bad, you just go bankrupt and the game's over. And that's not that bad.
Yeah.
I think the type of stuff that can happen in 1830 is I just floated this new company and, oh, there's no city tiles, I can't even start it. And I think that's the kind of stuff that's just like frustrating.
Yeah.
It's not like, ooh, the game got me. It's just like, well, this sucks. Like, I want to go back and undo all my moves, you know? Or, for example, like the double O tiles not connecting like you thought they would because they like run separate routes. And you're like, but wait, how do I get to the other side of this tile? Oh, you can't.
Yeah.
Like, that sucks. Yeah. You know what I mean? And like, oh, I need this green bend. Where? Oh, it's gone.
Yeah.
And there's only one. You know, so 1830 is hard.
Yeah, I also probably wouldn't recommend it as a first game, but I think it's still a good one to have in the collection because of that pure stock stuff you can get up to.
Definitely. I mean, I think if you're buying a collection of like a few games, it's definitely a good one to have because it's kind of the classic, you know?
Yeah.
But I suppose one could make an interesting point. If you had a collection of, let's say, like five games, if you had to choose between 1830 and 1889, like you would, I would say get 89 first, right? But then if you only had space for like three or four more games, would you get 1830 or is it too similar to 1889 to warrant a spot in a limited collection space?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
I don't know either. I don't know in 1830 actually, but Rudy does. So we just play his when we want to play it. But I think it's I haven't felt the need to, maybe it's mostly because Rudy has it that I haven't really felt the need to get it. I think if Rudy didn't have it, I'd want to own it.
Yeah, I do like it a lot.
Yeah.
It is a good game.
And I think we've liked that one more the more we've played it. And I think that's why it feels sort of like a step up, next level kind of game for me. Even though the rules aren't hard, there's just so many elbows. There's just like sharp edges at every turn in that game, which I think can be a little bit of a feel bad if it's your first 18XX experience.
Yeah,
man. So Cologne is a good step up as well. I think for an operational game, like a very operational kind of game, I think Rhineland is a really good step up. 18 Rhineland, that's from Marflow. Marflow games I consider pretty easy to get. He's got a website, he publishes them quickly. Like his turnaround time is like a week or two. So
yeah,
I think they're pretty easy to get. You just have to ship them from Europe. But
yeah, Rhineland also adds some other interesting things like partial cap changing to full cap and stuff like that, which is cool. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a very, like, it's quite an operational game, but it's tough.
Yeah.
It's very much about, like, managing companies correctly and getting things done at the right time and floating the right thing at the right time. So it's not like stock trashing and stock market shenanigans, but it's very much like managing your whole portfolio carefully. And the map is, there's a lot going on with the map as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good one. If you like that operational side, I think 18 Rhineland is really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've enjoyed that one a lot. And it's a real brain burner as well.
Yes. Yeah, it's a good game, that, yeah.
Yeah, so definitely kind of a step up. Other games then that I think I really like 1849. I think that's a good one to have. I just think it does a bunch of cool things. So that introduces some different stuff, like the dual gauge track, which we haven't really used very much, is cool. But I think the companies floating in different orders is quite cool.
Yes, that's very interesting.
And I just think it adds hex trains, which are quite cool as well. It just feels very different, but it's a very good game. I just think it's very good.
Yeah.
And it seems to be pretty much well-loved by most of the people that play it.
Yeah.
I'd say. So I think in terms of like just another game that's a good one to have, and I'd say like a fairly limited collection, I choose that one.
Yeah. How about, I don't know exactly where it fits in because I haven't played it, but it's fairly accessible, I think. How about Chesapeake?
Yeah, so Chesapeake, I think, is going to be another one of those great beginner games. I think it competes in a very similar space to 89 in the sense that it's like a pretty pure, full cap, sort of relatively. It's got a few little nice things to it that make it particularly beginner friendly, like the exporting train thing.
Right.
So like a non-permanent train just gets removed from the game every hour, I believe it is.
To speed it up a bit.
Just to speed it up, yeah. Might be every set of hours, probably. Otherwise it'd be a bit too quick, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's cool because that's sort of like for players who don't push trains fast enough. So I think that's going to be a really great beginner game as well. Those 18 AL is also apparently a good beginner game. We haven't played that one yet, but that's the one that was sent to us.
It's on its way. I think it's close, yeah. Maybe might have it next week. We'll see.
Yes, yeah. So I'd be keen to try that as well. So that's apparently pretty good as well. Yeah. That one's accessible in the sense that it's a print and play.
Right, okay.
So if you want like a first print and play, that's a good one to do. You can also freely print and play 1889. Also potentially a good one to try if you want to try your hand at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what other ones we've played that are good. I think that, yeah, there's a lot of different routes you can go, right? So if you want something very financial, then 1817 is supposed to be the granddaddy of like financial games. You had one failed attempt at playing that.
Yeah. Yeah, that adds a lot though. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's very much
complexity.
That's like huge next step stuff.
Yeah.
yeah, 1817, I think, is a real big step up. You can like short, and it's very stock marketing, very financial. So if that's the kind of thing that you like, I think that's almost the end step of like big financial games. Another good next step, I think, from something like 1889 is 18 Mechs.
Okay, we haven't played that one.
Yeah, so I've ordered that one because All Aboard Games is doing a nice run of that as well.
Okay.
So that one's pretty available. Also like an 1830 style kind of game. Similar trains, stock market, all that kind of stuff. Apparently there's a really brutal train rush.
Okay.
And it has like a nationalization merger thing that happens at some point. Yeah, so a couple of slight niggles on trains and stuff, but... yeah, I think a really cool one. Just adds a couple of little tweaks, but it seems to be very, very well loved.
Right, okay.
So cool. I think that's a good one as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of the Marflow stuff is very operational. Someone told me that they all are not very mean. He doesn't necessarily like meanness in 18XX games. So, I mean, 18XX games are pretty mean in general, but... yeah, you won't see a lot of like company dumping and stock trashing and stuff like that in Marflow's whole catalog.
Right.
Presumably, yeah. But I think Cologne is good for a two player or low player count experience. And I think it does some cool stuff. 89, we love a two player as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think of the ones we've played, those are the kind of ones that stand out to me.
Yeah. Then there's obviously the one 18XX to. Rule them all, 62, if you just want everything in one game.
Of course, I meant to mention 62. That's a great one for like a niche, like this does everything differently game. And I think it's really cool to own for that reason.
Yeah.
It's just like total, we've mentioned this before, but I mean, it's just totally off the wall. Like not like any other 18XX we've played.
And it should be fairly accessible now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we know it doesn't literally do everything that there is to do in 18XXs, but you have so much... choice. I mean, you can choose whether to float incremental or full cap, and you can do a little bit of it, almost everything in that game, I think.
That's like crazy stuff. So I think that's a great one to own, just for certainly not your first, second, or even third game you should play. But it's pretty great at doing that.
Yeah. It's fun, yeah.
Oh, and I wanted to mention about 49. The reason I brought up 49, sorry, that I didn't mention, is it's a partial cap game, an incremental cap.
Yeah.
So that's a full-on incremental cap experience. Like 46, where it floats at 20%, 49 is the same way. And obviously, in my opinion, a much better game.
Yeah.
So that does some cool stuff. It's got partial cap, like a pure partial cap, which is nice to have, because I think partial cap's quite fun. It's a fun thing to play around with when you can sell your own shares and... you like your company owns the shares and it floats immediately at 20%. Like it's a fun thing to play around with, and it's nice to have a game that's purely incremental cap like that.
And I think it's good to play one of those before tackling something like 62.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. And then it's got the operational side where you could got dual gauge track that you can sort of manage, and it's got the stock market where you can close companies, which is quite a nice thing to fiddle with. So it does a lot of like it does a lot of different stuff, but it's actually pretty accessible. Like it's quite an easy sort of next step kind of game. Like I wouldn't necessarily play it as your first, because just explaining all the different track and stuff would kind of be annoying. But it's not hard. It's not hard to understand, I don't think, at all. I think once you've tackled 89 a couple of times, something, you'd be ready for that. It's no big deal. I found it actually much easier even than Rhineland. Rhineland makes seemingly minor rules changes and somehow splits your brain in half. So Rhineland is like, it's so weird because you look at that rule book, like the changes seem so small from your standard 18XX, but it just completely changes everything.
Okay, cool. Do you want to recap the list quickly?
Okay, so we had beginner games. We had 89 as sort of the our almost sole recommendation there. But if you really want something more operational, then 61/67.
Yeah.
And if you have to, 46. Some people like it. And then so next step games in sort of each kind of tree. So the next step from 89, I think good ones are 1830 and 18 Mechs. I think those are both good choices. And then the operational side, we had Cologne and Rhineland, with Cologne being a little bit more of a hybrid. And then the sort of branches out from neither side of the tree in particular, 1849, which is the partial cap game that does hex trains and dual gauge and a bunch of things differently, but it's a great game and really, really cool. And then 1862, which is sort of the mad...
covers them all.
Covers everything craziness. So then on the hardcore end of the financial side, I think we said 1817 is one to look at because it just does crazy stuff. And I don't know if I mentioned 18 Rheinland in our recap, but that's also a great operational. I think I did mention it, eh? Yeah, great, very operational game that's very, very brain-burning.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, sweet.
Yeah, thanks for the question. That's
thank you guys for the question on Discord. Yeah, so should we talk a little bit about stock trashing? I think we spent a lot of time talking about collusion again. maybe some stuff I wanted to mention about it. So I was thinking about this recently and I was searching around and I found a post on JC Lawrence's blog that talked about one really good scenario for stock trashing, which I thought was something that could probably happen quite commonly and also something that I think was... Yeah, a good point.
Okay, and by stock trashing, you mean buying stock with the sole purpose of selling it to devalue. Right. So this is not something you'll do as much of in a game where the stock price moves down once only. It's something you'll do in a game where the stock price moves down for every share sold.
Exactly. Yeah. So the main games that you'd probably be playing with this are 1889, 1830.
Yeah.
Those sort of like relatively pure games where you just sell shares and they go into the bank pool and your stock price moves down for every share sold.
Okay.
So yeah, part of the strategy, and I think a lot of people probably would have thought of this before, is, well, what if I just buy four of your shares and then sell them? Because you parted 100 and now your stock is worth 65. Like, I've just cost you a bunch of money, right?
Yeah.
So I think a case that JC makes for doing this is in a game of 1830, as an example, if you come out of the private auction with either no privates or one like very cheap private. Because the point that he makes, and I think it's a point well taken, is that he says you are now losing the game and losing the game badly at this point in time. Because all these other people have money that can work for them much better than your money can work for you. Because they have private companies that they can sell in, they're going to be making big returns. Right? So whereas all you can do is float a company, but even the revenue you make from an early float of a company is going to be less than the revenue from the private companies. Right? So yeah, not great.
Yeah.
Not a great position to be in. Yeah, so he's basically, what JC says a lot is, if you're losing the game, change something.
Change the game.
Yeah, change it in some way. So he makes a case for this being sort of the prime time to do stock trashing. The reason that you do that is, the reason you don't necessarily always want to do stock trashing is that you often are giving up some amount of value. So let's say in stock round one, I buy 3 or 4 shares of your company or 5 shares of your company. Maybe not. You got to be careful, yeah, because, well, maybe it's good for you. I don't know. If you 100% play on a company, it goes up, right? So if you potentially bought all of someone's shares, you actually wouldn't lose money by trashing the stock.
Yeah.
Because it moves up. And then when they withhold, it sort of ends up in the same place.
Right. Yeah.
So all companies lose money in their first operating round because they can't buy a train until the end of the operating round. So, yeah, but with 100%ing, that actually changes the game there a little bit. But you have to be careful, I think, in the sense that they don't just dump it on you and float something new, because they haven't lost anything, but they get to buy through the trains or whatever and leave you with a company with 2 trains. So I think, we could do the permutations of this. I think
so you're talking specifically about stock round one now, but it's also possible in later stock rounds to buy and sell in the same stock round where you don't have that risk of them dumping on you. And something that I found quite fun is kind of like chasing someone for the presidency. Like, if someone doesn't have that much money, you can kind of chase them and force them to keep buying shares. So if you par the company, I can buy 1 share and you're still safe. You don't have to buy a second or a third share right away. But as soon as I buy a second share, if you want to keep the presidency, you now have to buy a share. So I can kind of chase you up so we can almost get 100% bought in that stock round. And then I just sell 4 shares and now I've devalued 6 of your shares without having lost any money myself, because I got for them what I paid for them back immediately.
Exactly. So that's exactly true, yeah. And I think that's a good point, is that there's often times when you do it where it won't cost you money, but it could cost you something else. It's costing you actions.
It's cost you opportunity as well. So what I found can be tricky to balance is, you have to look out. If you do too much of this, you'll end up with, because any share that you've sold, you can't buy back.
Yeah.
So you might sometimes want to, if I've bought 4 shares, for example, in your company, I might only want to sell 3 shares. But now I'm devaluing that fourth share or that single share that I have left remaining. But the reason you might want to do that is because if you do this to too many companies, at the end of the stock round, you might not be able to buy any shares anymore. So you might sit with dead money not doing anything for you because you've trashed so many companies and you can't buy back into their shares.
Especially if you can't afford to float your own.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's definitely a risk and something you need to keep in mind. There's oftentimes stock trashing is not just like a net zero for you. Even if it's net zero on money, there's opportunity cost or you can't earn any money or stock appreciation from those shares,
right,
et cetera, right? So that's when it becomes a problem, like you're saying.
Yeah.
So it's not just this thing, because I think on paper you'd think, why don't I just trash everyone's stock? That seems great.
Yeah.
But it's not always that simple.
Yeah. The other thing that I found that's really interesting about stock trashing as well is, I'm using you as an example because you're here, but let's say you've got presidency of a company and it's a good company. So I might, at the end of the game, I might want shares in this company because this company is going to go up in value. It's going to be a good company. It's going to always be able to run routes. It might even have a permanent train already. But as long as there's another stock round coming, there are situations where I could buy, let's say, 3 or 4 shares in your company. I could sell them all now, devaluing their share price. And if you look at the stock chart, like in something like 1830, it's possible to sell enough shares where I could get back into that company in the next stock round for the same price I paid this stock round, or even less, depending on how many shares I sold.
Yes.
So I lose out on dividends in the meantime, but I can still get back into that company in the next stock round for the same price or better than I could get into it now. But me dropping the price of your company now is good because it hurts you so much.
Yeah.
So if your company is, let's say, valued at 100 now, by the end of this set of ORs, which might be 3, assuming maybe you have a permanent train, so we might have 3 ORs, that company might be worth, I don't have the stock chart in my head properly, but it might be worth something like 125 or maybe even more, 150. And you've got, assuming, 6 shares of that. Whereas if I sell 4 shares now, next stock round, it's now back at 100 and I can get in then. But I'm kind of keeping you in check with running away. Also, in most stock charts, you can get to a point, if I don't trash your stock now, you can get to a point where you start hitting the ledges. And so there's like a window of opportunity where if you don't trash the stock now, you're going to hit a ledge and I won't be able to do it next stock round.
Yeah, especially for the lower pars as well.
Yeah.
If you par at 100, it takes like forever to get to a ledge.
Yeah.
But if you par at like 65 or 67 or whatever it is, then
they can hit a ledge quite soon.
They can hit a ledge quite easily. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I think that it's a good baseline strategy to have in mind if you come out of the private auction with no expensive privates at all, or actually no privates at all, especially in like a 5-player game or something like 1830.
Yeah. If
you come out with no privates or just like the one cheap one or something, it's a good thing to keep in mind, I think, as a baseline strategy, because other people are getting stock appreciation and their
private income.
Yeah, their private income.
And dividends, yeah.
And especially when they buy their privates in, that's when you can really fall behind.
Yeah.
So you need to do something to damage their appreciation. And this happened to me in a game of 1830 online. I got the CNA and I got like a Pennsylvania share, or I might have even been able to float Pennsylvania, which I was like, oh, I'm crushing it, you know. But then someone like trashed my stock completely. It was probably Joe, bastard. Someone trashed my stock completely. And like, I was in such a bad place, actually. Like, I just... oh, it was terrible. Like, I couldn't afford things and it was bad. Yeah, it was really, really bad. Because the reason that, especially if someone trashes the stock of your first company, another reason, and maybe one of the most important reasons, is that the typical thing you do is once you've looted your company, you'll sell down those shares.
Yeah.
So not only are they worth less, you actually can't sell them because of the 50% bank pool limit.
Yeah.
So if you put 3 or 4 of my shares in there and I've got 60%, which I wouldn't, 1830.
Yes. Now you can only sell 2.
I can only sell like 20%.
And at a lesser value than you would have before.
Yeah, so then I can't float another company. So then I'm sitting with this company with maybe like 1-3 train in it, chugging along, trying to earn money. It can put you in a pretty bad spot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Filling up the market as well.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. That's a huge aspect of it, which is which is pretty big. So yeah, I like that sort of like little mental shortcut to have in mind that if I end up in a position where I don't have the privates to then think, okay, I need to look at doing this kind of stock trashing thing. I think there's always kind of a nuance between sort of when is the right time and when isn't the right time. There's always sort of a fine balance. I think a point JC made was sort of like, well, shouldn't I just bid a lot on the privates then? But the balance becomes, well, not if you're overpaying.
Right,
if you're overpaying, then it becomes more worthwhile to be the stock trashing guy, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think an interesting kind of thing. One of the disadvantages to trashing someone else's stock is that you put shares in the bank pool for them.
Which pays to their company.
Which pays to their company.
Yeah.
So that can be quite a useful thing for them if they start running good routes and they have like 40% in there, their treasury starts getting funded with money.
Yeah, but also I find that when there are those shares in the market, they're now cheap because you trash the stock. Other players might start picking them up because they're cheap. So then it kind of also balances out that potential benefit.
Yeah, exactly. It depends on whether or not. And again, I suppose you should capitalize on those shares for that reason as well.
Yeah,
man. Interesting.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. So yeah, I think one of the things that was mentioned is what I thought was interesting is that a lot of sort of veteran, so to speak, players will actually, as soon as they buy their sixth share, they'll sell it. So they only own 50% of the company. So sort of like dissuade stock trashing. It's almost like a little bit of a good defense against it because now if you want to buy, so as soon as I float at 60, I immediately sell that share, basically.
Yes.
You couldn't do this in the first stock round, but you could do it in all the others with 1830 specifically. The rules vary on that. Some rules require companies to have operated or whatever. But anyway, for 1830, you sell it straight away. So now, if you want to trash my stock, you're doing it at a loss, essentially, because you'll have to buy it from the IPO at, let's say, 90, but you only sell it for 82. So you're losing on every share. So it sort of dissuades you from doing that as well.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's like a preemptive strike almost.
Yeah, so I think that's quite interesting. Just as keep in mind as a little bit of a defense against the waiting stock trashers.
Yeah,
that's a good one. Vultures circling your company.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, because they might be more incentivized than to just buy that share.
The one from the market, yeah.
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 And not worry too much about trashing your stock.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think that's most of what I wanted to say about it. I think the other big reason... Oh, sorry, I forgot about this, but this is really important. The other big reason to sell someone's stock is to manipulate operating order.
Yes.
Which is pretty huge. So that's something that's become more and more of a factor the more we've played is the operating order. So that can affect what price you float at. It can also affect, sometimes even selling your own shares to operate last.
Yeah, I'm actually in an online game doing it now where I want to operate first. So it's a situation where I was not first to act in the stock round. I think it's like stock round 4 or 5 or something, I'm not sure. Game of 1830. And three of us are floating companies this stock round, but I was the third person to par.
Right.
So, and we're all parring at the max. We're all parring at 100. But we're very close to buying the 5 train, which is going to close all the privates, and I still have privates that I haven't sold to my company. So I actually want to operate first in the coming OR so that I have time to buy my privates from myself. So I'm busy buying these other people's shares and selling them down to 90, hoping that they don't know that they can do the same to me.
Yeah.
So these aren't any of our listeners to the podcast, I don't think. This is just a random game of 1830 that I signed up for. So I'm hoping that they don't they don't actually have the money to do it, I don't think. I had the extra money lying around. I still had more than $100 after floating my company. So I think they would have to sell some other shares in order to be able to do it to me. So I'm hoping they don't.
And in this case, for them, they probably want you to buy that last 4 train.
But I can buy a 4 and a 5.
Right. But it's called the poison 4
it is,
for a reason, right?
Yeah.
So I think for them, they may be incentivized to let you buy it because they get access to better trains.
But actually, it's Erie that I'm floating. So Erie isn't forced to buy because Erie's first tile layer is on its home tile and it doesn't have a route already.
Oh, sneaky.
So I could get almost the best of both worlds, I think. I would be able to buy my privates from myself and not be forced to buy the poison 4. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
So if this goes according to plan, I think it's going to put me in a good spot.
Okay, you'll have to update us.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that you've highlighted probably the most common scenario in terms of manipulating operating order is buying the trains. Mm. So sometimes, let's say someone bought the poison four, so to speak, the last four train, and opened up access to the fives. Now, you are really incentivized to operate first if you can, because you could potentially buy both fives, for example.
Right.
Or you could buy two five trains, which is a really great position to have. Mm. To buy two permanents with one company's treasury is great.
How much do the fives cost again? 450.
450, yeah.
Yeah, because the six is?
630.
630. So you can't, there's no company that can afford a five and a six.
Yeah.
It's impossible because the max you can have in your treasury is 1,000.
So the only way you can ever buy two permanents is if you get to buy two fives.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is actually a really strong position, and that's a great thing to get. So sometimes you can compete for operating order in terms of that.
Mm.
The other situation is when you want to go actually second. Mm. And that's usually the case if a bunch of companies are floating at the same time, but there's like one four train left.
Yeah.
So you'd rather go second because the first guy will buy the four and the five, and then you get to buy two fives.
Right. Yeah.
So again, you get to be the guy who buys two five trains, which everyone wants to be.
Yeah.
The person who buys two five trains.
Yes. Yeah.
Very, very cool. Mm. So, yeah. So that's a little bit about stock trashing. I think we can come back to it if we...
I'm sure there's still a lot more to it that we haven't discussed.
But I think those are the good kind of baselines. I think manipulating operating order is big.
Mm.
And I like that sort of baseline strategy outlined of like, if you're the guy with no private companies, you are behind and you need to...
Do something, yeah.
You need to do something. So be the person who trashes stock.
Yeah.
And I also like the idea of buying the six share and immediately selling it to dissuade stock trashers. I think this is always a metagame thing, right? If your metagame and your group is very aware of this kind of strategy, then you need to start doing things to sort of safeguard against it.
Mm.
And I like the idea of just selling a single share because it's not like necessarily enough to totally put everyone off, but it's enough to maybe make them change their mind. Like, is it worth me taking this hit?
Yeah.
To do this, yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Sweet, yeah. Okay, so let's talk South African business, Fred.
Okay.
So last week I mentioned that I was in the Kruger Park, but I spoke about Jessica the Hippo. But I thought it'd be pretty cool to speak about the Kruger Park as well, especially since a couple of our patrons were actually talking about coming to it at some point.
Yeah.
Or it came up on their sort of list of places to go on a safari.
Yes.
Yeah, so I've been to Kruger Park lots of times. So it's called the Kruger National Park. It's our biggest game reserve. It is like 20,000 square kilometers, I think.
Yeah, just under.
Yeah. And we were saying, it's the size of Israel.
Yes, basically. About roughly, yeah.
And Wales.
How many Wales?
I think just the one.
Just the country.
Right? Yeah. No. So it was actually first established in 1898 by Paul Kruger, who was the president at the time. So old Kruger was very worried about all the poaching and sort of destruction of the animal and wildlife that was going on at the time. So he established it and then appointed its first warden, I think, in like the early 1900s or something. And I think that guy did a lot to, sort of grow it and build it from there. Mm. These days, it's a really, really awesome place to go. I think the easiest way to get there is probably from Johannesburg, where we live. So it's about a 4-hour drive for us.
It also depends a little bit where exactly you go. Yeah, there are different gates.
So it's huge and there are definitely different gates. The southernmost part is the most popular and apparently has the best game to see.
Okay.
So if you're going to do it, you should probably come in from the sort of Johannesburg side.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so sure. I don't know. Have you been there a lot?
Not a lot, but I have been.
It used to be one of our like favorite family holidays back in the day. So when I was a kid, we used to come there a lot and have these huge family reunions and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but I just thought we'd chat a little bit about it because it's a pretty awesome place. So it's quite cheap to go into. It's not cheap to stay in, but it's much cheaper. I think we mentioned this last week, to stay outside of it.
Yes. Yeah.
That's probably the better way to go. You can get a really nice accommodation just outside the gates and then just pay to come in each day.
Yeah, you pay like a day fee to go in.
Yeah.
Do your day-long game drive around the Kruger.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. So the way it kind of works, there's any number of companies that organize game drives where you have basically a guide driving around in one of those sort of raised vehicles. Mm. But the other way to do it is... basically just to drive around in your car.
Yeah.
Essentially. So if you were coming for a holiday, you'd obviously hire a car or something. South Africa, you is a very car place.
Yeah.
Our public transport really, really sucks. You essentially drive everywhere. So if you ever came here on holiday, you'd almost certainly hire a car. Unless you could Uber. We've got Uber, which is really good these days. But that's just for getting from place to place. If you're going somewhere like Kruger, obviously.
There's no Kruger for...
No.
Kruger Uber.
There's definitely no Kruger Uber. But it's really, really fun just driving around. We spend basically the whole day driving around. So we usually come in at like 8 in the morning or so, and we often are like rushing to get to the cutoff time of like 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
So we can easily spend a whole day in the park. And we did when we went there. I think we were there for like 3 or 4 days, and we spent every day just driving around. But yeah, it's really, really fun. So I'm sure most of you know this, but sort of the thing that's so cool about it is that it's not like a zoo. Mm. You're essentially just driving around an area of natural sort of wilderness with animals roaming freely. So the entire ecosystem and all of that is all intact.
Yeah, you can drive for hours without seeing a fence. Like
it's very big. It's massive. Yeah, you don't actually often see the fences at all, except when you come in.
So
you'll see all kinds of stuff happening. Potentially, if you're lucky, you'll see... We saw a lot of kills this time. Not active kills, but we saw a lot of like... lions taking huge bites out of zebras and stuff. It was pretty brutal. They're all like covered in blood and stuff, but it's quite cool to see. One of the cool things we saw was we saw a leopard up a tree, but he'd like arranged 3 impala, which is like a buck, like on a branch, which was kind of crazy. I'd never seen, because we know leopards drag them up trees, but I don't think I've ever seen it before, like the thing hanging from a tree. And just had like breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Yeah.
But apparently we heard later it was actually a few leopards that had all dragged something up there.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's just really, really cool because you never know what you're going to get. I think that's part of the excitement. There's kind of a thrill. It's not like when you go to the zoo, you know exactly what you're going to see and you can see it whenever. Like it's exciting to see a lion because it's like, ooh, yes, you know.
Yeah. There's also the big five that people always try, and it's kind of like a checklist that people always try and to see. Do you know all of them?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's the lion, the elephant,
the leopard, rhino, and buffalo.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a marketing thing, but it's pretty cool because every time you go, that's kind of your goal.
Yeah.
Like you want to see the big five.
Yeah.
I'd say ranked from hardest to see to easiest to see, I'd go leopard as the hardest.
Yeah, definitely.
Then lion, then rhino, then elephant, then buffalo. I'm pretty confident.
Yeah,
in this
that
ranking.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're probably pretty likely to see the easy three of those. So
yes,
the lion, elephant, and buffalo.
I had rhino as easier rhino. Than lion.
Oh, did you?
But Kruger,
that's a difficult one. Yeah.
You never know, man. You never know. So last time we went to the Kruger, we were there for like 3 or 4 days. We didn't see a lion once. We saw leopards twice. We saw a million rhinos. Like,
it might also vary depending on the season. When it's dry season, it's easier to spot things. But when it's green, it's more difficult.
Yeah. It's so weird though, because you just never know. This time we saw so many freaking lions, dude. Like we saw lions eating stuff like 3 different times. We saw them like munching on stuff, which was pretty cool, but you don't get to see that often. We got to a point where we like saw, so the fun thing about the Kruger is you always know something good is there because you see all these cars parked,
right?
Everyone's kind of jostling for position and stuff, but when it's not too busy, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
But it's cool because I like the sort of, there's this sort of cycle that happens. You roll up, there's like 10 cars there. You pull up next to someone and you're like, what are we looking at? He's like, there's a cheetah. You're like, whoa, a cheetah, seriously? It's like, yeah, okay. You see that tree that looks like a triangle?
Yeah.
You see the green bush behind it? Now go a little bit left and back. You see that tall grass? You're right there, you know? Yeah. So you always get this like long description because everyone's always so eager to be the one who shows you where the thing is, you know?
Yeah.
So I always like the like friendliness of it. There's always this like friendly thing and you're always talking to strangers. We had someone like flag us down, like we were driving and there was a turnoff we weren't taking. And the guy like waved us down and we stopped. He's like, go up this dirt road. There's a lion on a kill, like 100 meters up or whatever.
Wow.
Yeah. So I always like that. It's quite fun. Like everyone's always very excited to share where stuff is, you know? So that's kind of a cool aspect of it that I always enjoy. But yeah, you always know something's up when you see all these cars. Mm. So we pulled up once and this poor guy was so excited. He's like, oh, there's some lions there under a tree. And by this point we'd seen so many lions and they were like far away and we're like, oh, cool, thanks, man. We sort of like, we only hung around for a while because we didn't want this guy to feel feel like we didn't care.
Right. Yeah.
But in reality, we were like, oh, we've seen so many better lines, like, you know, like an hour ago. Like, let's go find a... And we saw Cheetah twice.
Oh, wow.
And you don't often see Cheetah.
No, you're lucky if you see a Cheetah, yeah.
Yeah, so that was quite crazy. So we had a really good run. We saw the big five.
Yes.
But yeah, this is what I was saying. So this time we saw like a whole bunch of lions and we saw a rhino once.
Right, yeah.
But it was great. We took this like random dirt road. There was nobody else on it. And the whole time we were like, we're going to find a rhino. My wife's like, go on this road. There's going to be a rhino. I can feel it. It was this like dirt road. We were rushing to get back to the gate.
Mm.
And we took the stupid dirt road and we were like, we're not going to make it. And we're going to pay this big fine because we were out after closing time. And we turned this corner and there's this huge rhino, like literally right by the road. Wow. It was like, had to stop like, whoa. Okay, sure. We saw rhino. He was beautiful though. It was so nice. Cool. And it was so funny. On this dirt road, we kept going and we came to this field, like totally flat field. And there were like six lions lying in this field. One was like on its back with its paws in the air. Yeah. No other cars there. Yeah. Remember I said there's like 10 cars for everything you see? Yeah. Here was just like lions like 10 meters from the road. Like just chilling, all like licking each other, like the best lion sighting you could hope for. Not another car in sight because we were on some random dirt road. And I was like, this is ridiculous. Like,
that's amazing.
Like we've been like squinting at lions through binoculars and now here's these dudes just chilling here. And we just like, wow, okay, pretty cool. Yeah. But it feels weird when you can't share it with anyone.
Mm,
when you're just like, there's no cars here. We can be like, guys, right here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, so it was really, really cool. So Kruger's super fun, though. That like, discovery and, like, looking for stuff. And I think it's such a fun holiday.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can drive around your car or you can go have guys drive you around. You can also go on night drives, which are really cool. You see different stuff on night drives. Mm. And that you have to have someone take you because you can't drive in the park at night.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but those are worth doing. So I think it's a super fun holiday.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think Kruger Park is a great game reserve.
Yeah, it's worth doing.
Cool one. Mm. South Africa has some amazing ones. Like, if you want to spend money, we've got some ridiculously fancy ones as well. Where you'll definitely see a lot of stuff as well, but it's like... So, where I grew up in the Eastern Cape, sort of at the... Quite south in South Africa, on the south coast or, like, southeast coast, whatever you want to call it. There's some really expensive ones there.
Mm.
Yeah, really, really expensive. Like in our money, like they go up to crazy stuff, like $15,000 a night or something, which is like, what's that in dollars? Like $1,000 a night or something.
Yeah.
Some crazy, crazy expensive ones. But it's where like Tiger Woods proposed and all of that. Yes. They have all these like celebrities and stuff that come through there.
Yeah.
So those are like ridiculously fancy if you want that experience. But if you just want like a normal experience, Kruger's amazing.
Yeah.
Really, really cool.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so if anyone comes to Kruger, please let us know when you're in Joburg so we can have a game.
Yes, yeah, we'll have a quick game before you settle for Kruger.
Yeah, exactly. Sweet. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. I think this was quite a long one, so thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Cool. Cheers.
Cheers. If you would like to get in touch with us, we are at derailed18xx on Instagram and Twitter. You can email us, derailed18xx@gmail.com, and we're on Patreon at patreon.com/derailed18xx. Thanks for listening.